is continuing with Jan Herbom on 15th August 76. So you went to Sweden briefly before.
Okay, way back in Sweden there was some further correspondence and every letter from Oates sort of finished on the note that he would very much like to see my thesis.
He's still hadn't seen it, right?
That's right. Well, it was finally sent. They found the suitcase and sent it to Sweden, so I could send the thesis. Well, then I was employed and went to Holland. That was then. I arrived in Holland the 1st and 4th of January 1960. Very cold. And I got the room there where nothing worked, essentially, so I immediately got the cold and had some trouble. But anyway, that was my beginning in Holland. Then there was Charles Seeger, and he was talking about a big cross with 5 kilometer arms. And, well, it wasn't so very, no detailed, really, detailed design, but he talked about 5 kilometer long arms, and that would be 10 to the something number of circularly polarized dipoles, and the beam would be swung by rotating these dipoles and so on. It sounded quite an enormous job.
This is a Mills cross, basically.
Mills cross, basically, yes. But nothing very, very concrete was done, because Charles Seeger was occupied with doing this polarization business, looking for polarization of the 400 megasec polarization of the background radiation. Then Christiansen arrived, 61 he was there, and that was very good for me. He taught me a lot, and we worked together, or rather, he gave me the impression we were working together, while in fact he was teaching me a lot. And when he left, design was at the, I think it was 1 kilometer or 1.5 kilometer across this time, but of individual dishes, there would be 100 of them. And they would be movable a certain bit, plus minus 15 degrees or something like that, in right ascension. So you could follow for a limited time. That's always a compromise between cost and what you want to achieve. And that was the design for a while, and then came Bill Erickson.
Well, the Christiansen design then was based on his experience with the solar arrays that he had, basically small dishes that could track for...
Well, his dishes down in Australia can track for 8 hours, plus minus 5 hours. But we had the cooperation very much with this fellow Hochhaupt, who had built Dwingeloo and Malvern, I think, too. And he could always tell us how much various things would cost.
So
he could tell us what it's most expensive to have a 25-meter dish to move for 2 hours, or a 30-meter dish to move for 1.5 hours, things like that.
Right.
So
what frequency were you thinking of?
That was 20 centimeters. So by getting to 20 centimeters, you could reduce the size of the machine and still have the same resolution, which was tentatively set at about 1 minute of arc, I believe. That's about what you get.
Were you thinking of the hydrogen line at all?
No, not at that time. I mean, it's known, of course, if you do have a 20 centimeter receiver, that's the thing that might come. But even at that time, you didn't extrapolate in the future as much as you do now today, or you did some time later. You don't extrapolate in the future to say that, well, in 10 years, 1 minute of arc will be commonplace. And one in 10 years, you will be able to have receivers with 100 times the sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I think you realize that it would be an advantage to be on 20 centimeter, because you could use the hydrogen line if something came around, but you didn't automatically take for granted that hydrogen line receiver is 100 times as sensitive as the one we were thinking about, would just be around the corner.
Right. Let me ask about the overall direction. Oort, of course, was the guiding light behind this thing, at least politically. Would you say scientifically also that he was the one who was defining the nature of the science that would be done with this?
Yes, well, the story went round that, of course, Oort is very interested in spiral structure, spiral arms, and the dynamics of things like that. So the story went round that he had a look at a map of Messier 51, which is the most beautiful spiral you have around, and decided how big hole he could put in the paper. can still see the difference between spiral arms and in-between regions, and that turned out to be about 1 minute apart.
I see.
And that defined the whole project. But it's probably... he doesn't work like that, but anyway, it
right.
tells you something
well,
about
but he may have done that, actually, at that stage.
Right.
And in fact, of course, it's rather interesting in terms of the first really striking result that did finally come out of Westerbork at about 1 minute of arc resolution was indeed M51.
Yes.
Some 10 years later.
Right. So the idea was anyway to have a big step, American thinking essentially, to reduce the normal half degree beam to 1 minute of arc about. And then it was essentially left to the engineers, say Chris or Charles Seeger or Bill Erickson, whoever were running the show, to suggest ways of doing this. And then there was this political steering, which was high up between the professors, and the, also an attempt to work together with the Belgians and have the Benelux cross and so on, and get funds for the whole thing. But I think we were more or less free to suggest new solutions, at least as they should produce about this performance.
Well, I'm also interested in the idea of aperture synthesis versus the cross. I mean, the cross is a pencil beam, of course, and
yes.
Is a bit different in principle from the final aperture synthesis concept.
Yes.
And yet, you say Oort had been impressed with Cambridge, who were just beginning to do aperture synthesis in the late 50s. With the lights thing and so forth,
yes.
Although it was not like the 1 mile. And I'm interested how
it wasn't an established and well believed thing as yet. I mean, I knew synthesis worked because I'd been here, but I wasn't. You see, I was still quite a greenhorn in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Just come from Cambridge. I knew the synthesis theory. I knew the standard way of synthesis. And I had been playing with rotational synthesis, in a way, in my thesis. But I didn't realize what possibilities were in it at all. So I realized, we were discussing, while Chris was there, to do it in East-West line and then move things out and have synthesis. But you see, that meant you had to steer them. No, nothing right. Sorry. To do synthesis like this, like the 4C badge.
Right.
I think it was I don't know why we took the cross instead of the other, but the advantages were not enormous. You had to run them on rails, you had to make them special, and also in any case if you're going to have 50 antennas you had to have mass production and all these things. So and maybe Chris felt happier with the cross.
Well, that was his past experience, of course, wasn't it?
Yes. Mm. Although he knew all the synthesis as well, because he was really involved in the very first experiments in drill synthesis, which was long before RAL started, back in Australia.
Would it be fair to say that when the 1 mile was being built and so forth, that at that point it became clear that this might be a good way to go?
In Holland?
Yes.
No, I don't know exactly what happened, because I was there and we did these various crosses, and there was talk about perhaps doing synthesis up and down or having a full cross and all these things. And then in 1962, I believe, came this first drawing of the 1 mile. I think it was even as simple as in the, or it was in the New Scientist or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
Where it didn't tell people how it worked, but it told that the new telescope was going to be 2 fixed antennas and 1 going on rails, fully steerable. And when I saw that, I realized what was going on. So then, the next day I came with a row of antennas to Oort and said, well, look, this is something which may, you know, you cut down the number of antennas from 100 to 20
right.
or whatever it is. Well, I made it first line with 20 or whatever it was.
Right.
But anyway, I knew enough of synthesis and played enough of synthesis. As soon as I saw that, I realized
right.
what was happening.
It was quick, yeah.
It's the next day.
And this would be about, what year would this be?
I think that was published in 62. That was when Bill Erickson was, or was it, had Bill Erickson left, or was it still there? maybe he was still there. But Bjørn Eriksen, essentially, we carried on developing this cross idea of dishes. And we were sitting on that for a very long time because that didn't seem to come any new thing. And it was such an enormous project, so it was going to be done in two steps. First, the inner part, inner third, which give you 3 minutes of our presentation, and later it was going to be developed and all these things. No hardware yet. I think Ort is a very shrewd fellow, and I mean, apart from the political trouble we were going on, he had a very strong intuitive feeling of what was right or not. I mean, I think he let this group run along, and he realized, well, Carl Seeger and I and Frank Kass and even Chris and Lyrickson and so on, well, this wasn't quite the right thing. You see, you should see that would be in that he probably felt intuitively that this wasn't quite the right thing.
The cross, you mean?
Yeah.
No.
That it was too clumsy or too big or something like that. Of course, perhaps we felt the same too. It was such an enormous project.
But you couldn't quite think of anything better.
No.
Yeah.
So I have the sneaking feeling, I don't know what, that Ort was in no hurry to handle the political things. Because he felt this wasn't the solution he hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
There was some... And... he has an intuition. Even
right.
Whether he has intuition technically, I don't know. So he didn't feel in his stomach that this was the right thing to build in the Netherlands. He let the group carry on. I don't know.
Until they came up with something better.
Maybe, yes.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting intuition that you had.
It's possible. Anyway, I mean, I felt the same when I saw this line of three antennas in New Scientist. I realized he was the order of magnitude we had looked after.
Right.
Get the same thing with an order of magnitude less effort. Or something like that. So, then it was a matter of convincing the people there. Because they had no experience of interferometry. I remember Lex Müller sort of had great difficulty in believing in it. He went through the mathematics several times and convinced himself that the mathematics was right, but he sort of thought this was too radical in a way. Anyway.
Was there worry about whether you could maintain phase that well?
Yes, well, everybody was worried about that. And, you know, Dutch machine is just 1 mile long. Well, it had been proven that it worked there 1 mile. I think when I suggested these things there, the narrow antennas essentially, and the camera support, I was again too young and too green to say that I would dare something different. I could only dare things that people told me definitely worked.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Hockhart said he could make dishes that were 25 meters or something like that. Okay, I believed him. And Ryle said that it worked at 1 mile. I believed him. So on. So in my first designs, just running the row like this, I automatically had it about that length without essentially thinking, you know, as you would do now, things. Resolution increases by a factor of 2 every 2 years or something, so you should do something different. But anyway...
I've read your ITR, in which you talked about that
I see.
In 65 or 66 or something.
Well, that was an exaggerated ITR,
right.
But it was sort of...
But it made his point very well.
No, it's turned out that it was a good design after all, because if you had made a large distances, well, you would have to do only from radio sources. Now you can do hydrogen line in a way you couldn't before.
Right.
And now they are building the outriggers, you get it twice as long. So it was a very flexible system, you could always build outriggers and get it twice as long. So that wasn't a very worrying point. I think the point was to... When I wrote that thing, I was just generally fed up with everything around because of there was lots of politics. And we felt also we weren't quite treated as a scientist, we were treated as hired engineers. Well, what's wrong with an engineer, but in an astronomical observatory, an engineer is not as good as an astronomer.
Right. When was this, about what time was the date of that ITR?
Well, I didn't know. But don't quote me too much on that one, because it's an indication that I was very annoyed several times in Holland. And, you do exaggerated things
too. I got the impression, I can't remember from whom, maybe it was Ort, that the Benelux cross became the Westerbork-East-West line when Belgium finally pulled out and there was only half the money left. So it seems like, in what you're saying, this is really wrong. It wasn't a matter of all of a sudden you only had half the money so you could only build half the cross. It was more a matter that Cambridge decided to do this, demonstrated that it could be done this way, and that you saw that this was a much more elegant approach. And so this is the way to do it.
Yes. Certainly, it wasn't a question of having the supersynthesis as an alternative to the cross, which was decided because you didn't have enough money. It wasn't the chief brother of this one, which you had to take when the Belgians left. No. It's quite possible, I don't remember all this. I did at one time write a bit about the various. That was about the time I wrote that ITR write-up for myself, some of the steps in the same vein about the jumps hither and thither, but the cooperation with Belgium had been difficult politically, I understand. It had been hard work because the Belgians weren't as organized as the Dutch were. And it's quite possible, if Hood said it came about the same time, I believe him, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite possible that it came, but I don't know. It came because now there was a cheaper alternative available, I don't know. You could afford to pull out.
Exactly.
I don't know the politics about that. My impression is that political trouble and disorganization among the Belgians made it impossible anyway to run together with them, and everybody was happy when they left. Was happy when the Dutch, who were obviously very well organized, could handle it on their own. And it's possible that it was helped along by the fact that now the cheaper design was available.
Which could do the
but time it was time. The design itself, certainly, that it was chosen on its merits, on its scientific merits.
A question popped in my mind, and I should have asked it earlier, when you said that perhaps the 2C troubles led to people being afraid of interferometry and leaving the field for Ryle. Do you have any comments on why it was that Caltech did not do supersynthesis? They could have done it from a very early stage when they had those 290 footers, and yet they didn't. I'm trying to understand why this is.
I don't know. For one thing, they weren't. Are they steerable in plus minus 90 degrees?
Well, I think 60.
60 degrees, 60. Yeah, okay. And did they have the phase stability at the time?
Well, I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. The dishes were finished in 59 or 60, and so it would have been difficult.
No, and you see, still they are not doing too much synthesis. I think it's because you knew that synthesis was a new and to many people a very difficult thing to do, and you knew you had to cover the UV plane and there were horrible things happening if you didn't know what to do and so on. So I think the combination of the 4-hour tracking plus minus and mm-hmm. not being sure about phases, and also I believe they had the double sideband things, which still is okay, but it was again a new technique. So I don't know, because even today they are occasionally doing things.
Like well, they do quite a bit of hydrogen line synthesis in the last few years.
But you know, if you do put together 4-hour tracks here and there and then fill in with north, south, and so on, you have to be quite sophisticated to get a good map out.
Yeah, even today.
Even today, yes.
And to start off that way when no one had demonstrated that it could be done, even when you had nice tracks and all, that's true.
That's what happened to Wim Rajoy. When I was late, and when was he died?
To Rajoy?
Rajoy.
He died in 67 or 8 or something like that. Yeah.
Well, he came back then from America, from Caltech, just before he died, before he died or something. And then he had brought with him this type of measurements. which presumably he had made in 67, 68, yeah. or 66, 67.
Right.
So that was reasonably early for synthesis, Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
And he had then had North, South, and East, West filled in. And he had the measurements along, and when he died, the measurements were lying there. And Ort gave them to... What was her name?
Folders?
No. This American was doing the gold belt and blue stars and things like that.
Lesh?
Lesh, yes. No. Yeah, Janet Lesh.
Yeah. Roundtree was her name,
maybe. Roundtree, yes. I don't know why she got them, because apparently, that was a sort of job. Would thought that anyone could be using that for that thing. So he couldn't. Well, nobody could at that time, because it was just an irregular carriage and so on. And, they were lying around there in Cambridge, in Leiden. And I was aware of these things, and I had to go at them, and I couldn't do anything sensible to them. And,
where were these maps of? The Galactic Center region?
Yes. So it was not really until I cooked up this cleaning machine, which was around 70 or 68, 70, that you could do anything about those. And by that time I was busy moving, getting myself, and since nobody else thought he could do anything about them, these cars went along with me to Sweden. And then finally, in a lot of other things, Sandy came to me and said, well, look, didn't you have some measurements of the Galactic Center? He was having his, lunar rotation. So
right.
He was interested. So I said, yes, we had a look at them, and we ground them through the clean process, and out came back. But I can imagine that things like that, people didn't know how to handle this.
Sure.
Up till 1968 or something, nobody knew how to handle that.
Right.
At least if there wasn't a very simple model of a double source. But I don't know, you better ask someone. I have had very little contact with Caltech. You better ask him now, Kim Kellerman.
Yeah. What about your year in Australia? You said, when was that you went to Australia?
That was the end of 63, it was there during 64.
And what did you work on there?
I tried to see fine structure in the background of the organization. The question I brought with me was about this big spur, which looked like a supernova shell or something like that. So I thought, if it is a supernova shell, it might have fine polarized structure inside it, not outside it. There would be a qualitative difference between what the background looked like with a high resolution inside and outside. But the funny thing is really that the Cambridge education had told me something, but it hadn't told me how to work on my own very much, really. So I drive there, and they treated me like a grown-up scientist. And yes, time on Parkes telescope and all these things. So I ask for time, and suddenly I'm in a telescope. I had sort of vague notions about what to do. But in any case, I did these things. I scanned through and test scans inside and outside. And I found a difference. But since I wasn't very trained on tilted power machines, I was rather incompetent to handle that telescope. So although the data was there and I saw differences and things like that, they were in a sort of messy shape, and I couldn't bring myself to publish that type of thing. So in the process I learned something about big dishes.
Right, but
in Cambridge.
But Cambridge hadn't taught you about big dishes, but certainly had taught you, I would think, to work by yourself in interferometry and so forth.
Yes.
Right. You said that it hadn't taught you to work by yourself.
Well, no, okay, to talk about big dishes, to think up a problem on my own and go about solving it. I still have difficulties with that. Because on the things I was doing in Cambridge, the idea came from someone else. The idea came from Rad or from Tony Uish or someone else. And, say, the typical thing about all these occultation measurements and so on was that Tony had lined up roughly what experiments to be done, what antennas to handle, and what essentially the one was good to look for. And with that instruction, I could handle the situation
right.
then.
And this is typical of at Cambridge. It was very seldom that a student came up with an idea, said, "Look, I want to try this." And,
no, I don't. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know really. This is just a matter of my own personal background. I think I hadn't got that type of training in my undergraduate, or it wasn't in myself.
Yeah, I think that's true of the other students also that I've had contact with. What about in Australia? How did the philosophy of doing science there strike you versus Holland and Cambridge?
In a way, of course, the CSIRO is a very much bigger place, but you looked at Cambridge from the outside, you realized that there was, even though Australia looked very different from Leiden, that was the outside world, and Cambridge was a bit of an inside world. There were people streaming through from other observatories, people streaming through Leiden all the time. Lots of people from States and India and so on in CSIRO, but very few people who are not under the actual guidance or in Cambridge. I suppose I was the first one coming from outside Commonwealth, but also I didn't come from another observatory. I didn't come from a competing observatory in any way. I got my basic training as a scientist from there. Now, of course, things are different. There are people spending time here in Cambridge, even people from competing observatories. But at that time, I don't remember when I did that.
I don't know of any cases of people spending a year from any other radio place in the 50s.
No. Yeah. They were all close and, well, okay, that might have been the time.
And so what you're saying is that when you went to Australia, this struck you very much.
It struck me that the place was full of people from other places. Now, not full, but in comparison to Cambridge.
Right.
You know, Radha Krishnan came there on the trimaran and you know, that type of thing.
Right.
Plenty of Americans. I got to know Ken Kellerman there.
That ends the interview with Jan Herbom on 15th August 76.